All right, my shit show ladies, let me tell you about how I can make getting dressed so much easier for you. Armoire is a clothing rental membership where you get to build your perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you gotta do is take a 5-minute style quiz and then select from your personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new to you styles. So I love this because I'm on video quite often on interviews and social media content, and I don't want people to be like, is that the only shirt that this girl owns? I also would not consider myself in the know of what's hot and what's not. But with Armoire, I get to pretend like I'm a fashionista. So this is perfect for working moms, for stay-at-home moms, for any women who just don't feel like going to the store. Now, right now, you shit show ladies can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off your first month. So that is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/littlechild. That is armoire.style, armoire.style/littlechild to get 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear ever again.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
I can still crack a joke mid-meltdown, and that's why everyone is lucky to have me in their life. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows.
Shit Nation.
It's been kind of a while since I've done that. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I am a recovering alcoholic. I am a recovering adult child, former identified patient and scapegoat of my family. And this podcast is the culmination of many years of pain, many years of toxic relationships, not being able to figure out what the hell was wrong with my man picker, and then coming to the realization in 2018 that, in fact, my childhood fucked me up a whole lot more than I initially thought it did. I highly recommend going back to the very beginning of the podcast and listening to the first 10 or so episodes, which you will get to hear my story. And this is also where I lay the foundation of what the hell an adult child is. So welcome aboard this hot mess of a ship. We curse here. You've been warned. So today we are diving deeper with the man, the myth, the legend, Tim Fletcher, a pastor turned drug and alcohol counselor turned YouTube sensation out there saving the world, healing the world with all of his amazing content on complex trauma and dysfunctional families and addiction. If you have not listened to part one, I highly recommend that you go listen to that first. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So let's get the damn show on the road. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show. This is my online support community. I just want to say that this is not an official ACA group. This is not affiliated with the 12-step program, ACA. We do definitely, many of our members are a part of the ACA community, and we definitely use some of that literature. But this is a support community for those who are willing to refer to themselves as recovering shit shows, right? This is where we embrace the shit show. This is where you can connect with other people who are doing the damn work to heal, which is not for the faint of heart. Okay, am I right? So we have 4 Zoom groups a week. We have a couple of other meetings going on. We have all these sub-communities that you can be a part of. Damn the Join Shit Show, okay? Damn the Join Shit Show. See the link in the show notes to join next. Give me a little follow on Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Job Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Please do not pass go. Please do not collect $200 unless you do so. Thank you, love you all. You don't call at all. It's a shame the way you mess around with your man. It's a shame the way you. Let's circle back to the shame piece. What do you think are some of the, you said there's 70 questions. Are there some that you think are the real gems? Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, so most people with shame feel that for a relationship to work, they have to be willing to give up their needs and take care of them. And so they tend to go, because they basically believe if people get to know me, they're going to reject me and neglect me like mom and dad. So I have to put my needs aside. I have to keep my personality hidden in order to get people to like me and want a relationship with me. And so they go in wearing masks, number one, putting their needs aside, number two. But what they don't realize is they just set themselves up for a codependent relationship, for an unhealthy relationship. They set themselves up as an inferior and made the other person superior, thinking that that's how you earn love. With that is, I have to keep my needs hidden, because if I express my needs, they're going to see me as a burden or a pain.
Yeah, needy.
Needy. And so I can't ever express my needs. And then also with that is I can't say no, I can't set boundaries, because they're going to think I'm rejecting them. They're going to think I don't like them. And if they set boundaries with me because I'm too needy, then I'm going to feel rejected. I don't like boundaries. I don't know what to do with boundaries. And so those are some of the main ones that come. Then I think the other big one for people is, so shame basically says, I don't have value inherently. I don't have value just from being. My value comes from doing. My value comes from external. So how do I have value? Well, I have a great body. I have a great job. I have lots of money, blah, blah, blah. And so if I was to take any of those things away, then I would feel nobody would want me. Because I don't have value internally. And so it's helping people realize if your sense of value only comes from externals or from doing, you're not a human being, you're a human doing. And that's going to cause problems constantly in relationships. That's a shame, core shame issue. And that's where I get my value from, is one of the core issues of shame. They hit 40 and they begin to realize the things I was depending on for value, I'm starting to lose, and I'm finding they're not as satisfying as I thought they were going to be, because having all the money and the cars and the house isn't doing it anymore. I need to make a change. But you still look to get your value from something else externally. I just need a hotter car. I need a hotter body, whatever. Those things, midlife crisis, another aspect of it.
Yeah, it makes me think about The whole, like, you know, being seen as a burden. When I would be dating a guy and let's say they did something wrong or I caught them in a lie or whatever. And of course I would keep everything for my friends until I'm like having a meltdown. And then I tell them like what's really going on. Right. And so I could never confront like somebody, a guy, about what they did. So I would literally make up conversations with the guy to tell my friends so that they would be like, okay with me continuing to see the person. I would, and never once was it even a consideration to bring it up to the person.
Yeah. So if I can just add a few things with that. So What happens when you have shame is basically, I can't let people see what I think is the real me because they'll reject me. So basically I must lie to survive. And that is, can be wearing masks. That can be become a chameleon. That can be actually telling lies. The second piece is I have to avoid conflict, and angry people scare me to death because basically if I'm in conflict, I might be wrong. And if I'm wrong, you're going to reject me. Wrong, that means I am all that I feared, my shame said I was, I'm not good enough. So I hate conflict. I run from conflict. It's peace at any price. I'll never rock the boat. Always keep the other person happy, take care of their emotions. They're always happy. And then I have to be happy all the time too, because if I'm sad, that might upset them. So you start a whole kind of radiates outward, one thing after another I have to do in order to avoid conflict, in order to avoid being seen. So another piece with that, and you've mentioned it, is if a child is neglected or abused and they're too little to fight or flight, then they go to freeze or fawning. And fawning is, I still need them to meet my needs because they're my parents, but that means I have to get them to like me. I have to learn how to please people. I have to learn how to schmooze. I have to learn how to wear masks, be a chameleon, be whatever people want me to be. I got to be super attuned to everybody else so that I know how to respond on a moment's notice so they like me. That fawning is an extreme form of survival, but that is also a shame that can never be me. It takes shame to even be with them.
So you mentioned the, like, I'm more than or less than. I guess it's kind of similar to what Bradshaw talks about as far as like shameful acting out and shameless acting in. Just like one, you kind of like lean into the shame and act accordingly versus like trying to be perfect.
And so the flip side of that is, so the kind of that superior, it can go from people pleasing to I got to be a perfectionist because if I do everything perfect, then people will respect me and like me and I'll be good enough. Unrealistic standards for yourself. All of those things begin to happen. But then it can go to the narcissistic type of qualities. I have to be right. I always have to get my own way. I always have to be look good, show weakness in emotions. I can't show empathy. I can't show sadness or cry. I got to be strong all the time. So there's a spectrum of how that superior stuff can work out. But at the extreme end of the spectrum is the narcissist. There's a spectrum on both. And from I don't like myself, I am a miserable child, I never have any needs, I'm always pleasing people, doing whatever they want, taking care of people, to the self-harm. I hate myself. Do stuff to hurt myself because that's what I deserve. Broad spectrum, different places.
How would you say typically with traditional family roles, typically are we seeing like hero, maybe mascot, like on the upper end and lost child scapegoat on the bottom?
So if I can just camera lens for a little bit first. So me, adult children, adult alcoholics or dysfunction, complex trauma, always, when you look at the family structure, there's a narcissist type person in a, who's abusing that position of power. So instead of meeting the needs of the children and loving unconditionally, they're making it about them. They're getting things the way they want. They're the boss. All of that is part of the family structure. So everybody else has to adapt in order to please that narcissistic personality. And so you get the hero. I'm going to be the perfect child. I'm going to do extra chores. I'm going to be super responsible. Then the narcissist pats me on the head and says, you're such a good kid. Or I'm going to be the comedian and make the narcissist laugh and make everybody happy. And I get patted on the head. So the first two, they get validated for their roles. Then you get the invisible child. And sometimes they get validated because they never cause any problem. Sometimes they don't get validated because they never put themselves out there and they kind of get picked on a little bit. Audie expects them to stay hidden. But they're, so that one's a mixed one. But then you get to the scapegoat, and that's the only one that refuses to be dishonest about the narcissist. They're the only one that says, this family is actually kind of sick, and I'm not willing to conform. And so now they get called the bad child, the problem child. And whenever there's a problem in the family, now they're the scapegoat. It's because of that child. They're such a bad child. That in reality, they're actually the only honest child, emotionally. Sadly for them, that many of them develop kind of the ODD. I'm just going to become the rebel in everything in all of life. That's going to be my identity, and I'm going to maintain that identity, and that gets them in trouble. Other three, which can be validated, they can coast through life for 20, 30, 40 years, and it seems to be working, and then start burning out. Then they start realizing they can't have intimate relationships because they always got to be funny, and they never talk deep about anything. And so what you get with those early adaptations is a 20 to 30 to 40 year gap before you get the consequences. So many people, they go, how could this have anything to do with child rights? But that was 40 years ago. What's problems today from back then? Well, because there's that delayed gap that happens with those who are validated.
I've never heard that, but boy, does all of this hit home. So scapegoat identified patient, only child. I found out my mom was an alcoholic when I was 7. We were out to dinner one night and I could tell that something was off. And at a certain point, my mom took me to the bathroom and I said, what's wrong? And she said, I'm an alcoholic. And of course, I don't know what that means, but she's like, it means I can't drink. And it was like, I went to bed that night and like developed like a sixth sense to her drinking. You know, it was like, I skipped several stages of development. And so my dad was very successful. He traveled a lot for work. When my mom drank the most was when he was out of town. She was always a periodic, you know, like binging. Months would go by without incidents, but you know, he knew that she was driving me around drunk, you know, nothing ever horrible happened, you know, but like my needs were always accounted for. We went on a ton of fun vacations. We went to church, all the things, right? But when my dad was in town, I became his Watson, essentially, like his sidekick. I mean, 8 years old, helping him search the house for my mom's booze, going into the liquor cabinet and using a paint stick to measure and monitor how much was in each bottle. Nobody knew about her drinking, so I was also his emotional support and confidant. At the age of 9, I started to develop separation anxiety. Started with not being able to go to sleepovers. And then one night I woke up in the middle of the night and felt like I was going to die if I couldn't sleep in my mom's bed. And it started the cycle of me falling asleep in my bed and then switching places with my dad in the middle of the night. And after a few months of that, they sent me to see a therapist. And I remember asking them years later, did you ever tell that therapist that you were an alcoholic and that you guys fought all the time? And her answer was no, it didn't seem relevant. And 12 is when I started drinking and using drugs. 13, I became essentially like the school slut overnight and lost all of my friends and got kicked out of that school. 8th grade, I got sent to rehab for the first time. And then I spent the next, you know, from until 19, I got sober. I became a daily drinker at like 16. But you know what, Tim? It worked in fixing the family for that period of time. When I started to act out, they got their shit together because they had to deal with me. And so that I leaned into that toxic shame. I'm glad that they did it because it helped me to get, you know, I think it helped me hit my bottom faster. But subsequently, what has happened is like once I got sober, it's been a downward spiral for the both of them. They are both horrible alcoholics, way worse than it was when I was a kid. Thankfully, they're supportive of like, they're proud of, like a lot of parents would be go scorched earth and like write them off for doing what I do, but they're proud of me. Obviously they can't listen, but you know, my mom is so sick. Her alcoholism is just so far progressed. I know it's all trauma. And my dad has, you know, he wants her to get better, but he doesn't because he wants to keep things the way that they are. And so they've become very, you know, obviously I've kind of got them in their place, but what it talks about where like, you know, they'll take any opportunity they can to try to put me back in that role, right? And I'll stand pretty firm. But so I had the most fucked up conversation with my dad this past Saturday. And I've figured out a way to have a relationship in which it works for me. I have a lot of boundaries. I spend very little time to them. I stopped. It's like now I don't participate in the dysfunction, but I also don't participate in the family denial. You know, I don't try to carry the elephant out of the room, but I don't ignore the elephant. My mom is in the hospital now for pancreatitis. She went in on Friday. I mean, this woman's fallen downstairs, broken ribs, broken her heel. Like she pretty much now just like doesn't do anything other than drink. And my dad he's also an alcoholic now, but he doesn't get as sloppy as her. He doesn't really have the consequences. Got to dinner with him on Saturday night. Halfway through dinner, he goes, "I want to talk to you about your mom," and goes on this long rant about how it really hurts him that I'm not closer to my mom and that I don't support her more and that he knows that they're flawed. Like, you know, he goes on this long and I go immediately into a trauma response. And he's like, "So what are your thoughts about that?" And usually like these sort of like when he's done this in the past, like it'll turn into like a blow up. He'll rage, but it didn't. But so my legs were on fire and he was like, and I paused. And I really took my time like to think, how the hell do I want to respond to this, you know? And they have done cruel things to me over the past few years, you know, like changing locks on how, like just trying to punish me in any way. Like it's been so fucked up. And so what I said to him was, "You made me responsible for my mom's alcoholism when I was 7 years old, and you're doing that to me again." And he just kept going on and on about how he's just trying to bring the family closer together. He just went, and I go, "You know how you can do that? You guys could stop drinking." And his response in the whole conversation was just like, "No, you should be able to just handle it." He said, "I've dealt with my brother's alcoholism my whole life." I said, "You really want a close relationship?" He goes, "It really hurts me that you're not closer with your mom." And I said, "It really hurts me that both of my parents are dying from alcoholism." It was so fucked up. It was so fucked up. My mom is in the hospital. She's supposed to get out today or tomorrow. My dad's flying out to Lake Tahoe on Wednesday because he's got friends from his Bible study that are going golfing with him. And it is like the disease, like the level of dysfunction and denial, the longer that this goes on, it's like, that's what I realized. Here were my two options. In order to be unconditionally loved and accepted, I had to either one, submit and tolerate the unacceptable, or two, become the problem so they don't have to look at theirs. And that's still fucking going on today.
Number one. But if I can just kind of analyze that a little bit.
Let's do it, baby.
Okay. So to me, what your dad has done is like a pure narcissistic response.
Yeah.
So a pure narcissistic response is, I can never own my part. I will never change. So the problem, it's always somebody else's fault. I will continue to try and do faults or do things to blame to try to explain my problems so that I don't have to change or get honest, so I can stay in denial. And narcissists do is they've gaslit their children for years. Mm-hmm. Say, "It's your fault. It's your fault. That's why I'm mad. That's why mom drinks, whatever. Bring enough. You should be conforming is the bottom line. So they create a dynamic, gaslight the children into, it's always their responsibility to do all the work and to change. And if something's wrong, it must be their fault. And children believe this, but they're conditioned by that. And so what narcissists tend to do is always go to the fallback when things get really bad, go to the fallback of the children because they've already been gaslit. Let's bring them back into the web of lies, the web of distortions, and get them to conform to their role again and admit that probably they're the ones that's causing all of the problems. I've watched so many people get drawn back in over and over again, and it's the years of gaslighting and conditioning that took place that they just slide back into without even realizing it. And so that's why I say good for you for going, you want to solve this problem? It's not me running back in here.
Yeah.
Stopping.
You want to have a closer relationship with me? Guess what?
Exactly.
There's a way that you can do that.
And so another way to look at it is this. A narcissist who always is, I'm the strong one, I'm the leader, I'm the right one, etc., is actually always playing the victim.
Yeah.
And it's always somebody else's fault. It's always somebody else to blame. I don't have to change. Poor me. Look at how bad my life is. Everybody else is not helping out the way they should. Victim, victim, victim. When they're in a relationship, it's two victims living together, refusing to be honest, change, or what their part is, and looking for everybody else to fix it and somebody else to blame. And it's just such a sad thing. And until they break through that denial, nothing will change. And that's why so many people have to set pretty rigid, strict boundaries with parents like that. And like, to me, good for you that you've figured out boundaries where you can still have a relationship, but really keep them at arm's length for the most part. Some figure that out and it's fantastic. Others have to go kind of no contact for a while. They can't figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it gets to a point, right, where it's like the neural pathways are so grooved in that like it's virtually impossible for them to come out of denial, you know, just like can you just explain just the progression of denial with a system like this and just the warped reality that has to occur in order to be able to continue going on with life?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to understand is that all trauma typically has a little bit of denial.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look back at a child that has this tremendous amount of pain that they can't resolve, and the pain is almost too great for the nervous system to handle, the brain then has to go to a certain level of denial or dissociation to cope. So it blocks memories, it can flip a switch and just deny that it's happening. It can get busy in a distracted world and deny kind of what's going on in the real world. So now it becomes an essential part of survival in trauma. To break that down, what you begin to realize is denial not of this circumstances so much, it's a way of dealing with pain that's too great to deal with. And so when a person is in adult life and they don't need to deny anymore, dynamic there, and that is if they get honest, much pain, stay in denial. But then the longer you stay in denial, the more you continue in unhealthy behaviors, which is actually adding to the pain pile underneath. But now if I go to that pain pile, it's going to be even more painful than it was a year ago. So let's harden the denial even more. Let's stay distracted even more. Let's tell even more lies to ourselves. Let's blame somebody else even more. That'll allow us to not deal with that pain. And so the older people get, they're kind of caught. The pain pile is getting bigger, which then drives them to even greater denial, which means less chance of them ever changing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad to watch, but it just happens all the time.
Yeah, it's devastating. I think being an only child really fucked me up too, you know, having that all on me.
Yeah, and I think to me that it leads to kind of a core shame message, which is if you get to know me, so if I get honest about me and my problems and what's going on in my life, then not only are you going to reject me, you're going to abandon me.
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody at 70 or 80 has been in shame all their life and denial all their life, and now there's all this growing pain, if they were to get honest about that, what they're definitely, the fear is an even greater pain of abandonment. everybody's going to abandon.
Do you know how many times I've set the intention that on Sunday, I'm going to get up, I'm going to plan my meals out for the week, I'm going to go to the store, I'm going to get everything that I need, I'm going to come home, I'm going to make all my meals for the week. Do you know how many times I've actually been successful in doing that? Not once, folks, okay? Not one single time. But alas, I have found the perfect solution. Meet Sunbasket, a team of dietitians and chefs that design wholesome, nutritious, and delicious meal kits delivered to your damn door. You get to pick and choose what you're in the mood for every week. Maybe one week you're feeling Mediterranean, maybe another week you're feeling a little carb consciousness. I like the sound of that. I most recently made, it was a spinach and strawberry salad with steak. It was damn good. So go to sunbasket.com/adultchild today to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/adultchild to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order. Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway. Night sweats. Poor sleep. Feeling tired all the time. Bloating. Gas. Man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ADULTCHILD at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ADULTCHILD for 15% off today. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? So Katherine Heigl, you know her from Grey's Anatomy, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says that she's seen more issues with dog joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to improve any dog's health: their food. So what she's discovered is that the way many dog foods are made can actually create toxins that could be wrecking our dog's health. But fortunately, she has found that by just adding a few special superfoods to her dog's food, she saw huge transformation in their health. And she has made a 20-minute video explaining step-by-step how anyone can do this same thing to see incredible changes in their dog's health. Now, y'all know I'm a cat lady. Y'all know that Kiki is the queen of the shit show here. But I watched this video and there's actually some things that I can apply to her health. So hopefully she'll live another 15 years or so. So go to badlandsfood.com/adultchild and watch Catherine's video. Again, that is badlandsfood.com/adultchild.
Everybody's going to... If I get honest about how ugly I feel I am, nobody's going to want to be with me. So they're caught. The fear of abandonment keeps me in denial, because fear of abandonment would just add megatons of pain to the existing pile of pain. I'm caught in this prison of avoiding pain, but it just is adding pain, which means greater denial necessary.
Yeah, and the parentification aspect of it, you know, I found it all exciting, actually, as a kid. You know, I remember sitting on the steps and listening to them fight like a moth to a flame. And I remember, like, you know, maybe I would be suspecting that something was going to happen, like there was going to be some sort of drama, like with my mom's drinking. And in the rare chances it didn't, I remember being let down. And it's like, that was my first addiction, right? Was like to the chaos and dysfunction that was, you know, within the home. And so there wasn't a lot of pain or sadness there. You know, there was.
But I would take excitement for Andrea. So definitely what happens with all of that is addicted to chaos and drama. But to me, there's a bigger piece. So looking back on you, I would suspect from what you've told me is there wasn't healthy attachment. There was shame early.
Oh, you think? You don't think so?
There was shame early on from neglect and what was going on with mom and dad. I must not be good enough. I must not be loved. But also, typically, there's when you're parentified, your legitimate needs you've put aside and you're taking care of everybody else's needs. So you're not getting validated for who you are. Your only source of validation is you're good at taking care of your mom. You're good at doing this. And what a child needs validation. A child thirsts for validation. So a child begins to thrive on being a parent because it gets me validation. But to be a parent, I now need drama. Parent, then I get validation, which solves my shame.
Yeah, you know, because it's like the only time that my dad was emotionally available to me was when my mom was drunk and emotionally unavailable to him. Shocking that I've turned out to date emotionally unavailable alcoholic men. Shocking. Combining them both, baby. Let me get mom sober and let me get dad's love.
Exactly. And so, like, to me, you weren't feeling at a conscious level pain, but at a subconscious level, that shame pain was real. And that longing and thirst for validation was always there. And so you found a way to get validation, or towards being a parent. And now you needed the drama to be a parent on a regular basis to get the validation. And so to me, it still goes back to complex trauma and the shame.
What about when it comes to parentification, as far as how, you know, performing duties or being put in a role that you are not emotionally and psychologically like ready for, and, you know, and how that causes you to miss or skip formative phases of development? How do you describe that?
So say it is for many children growing up that got put into this parent role, weren't able to be children. They had to be super responsible. They couldn't play. They couldn't explore. So the things that a child does to figure out who they are, to figure out what they're good at, to figure out what their passion is, skip all that and be a parent. But then what can happen with that is you get told, oh, you're good at this. Oh, this is what you're cut out for. So you're actually being gaslit. You're not doing your personal exploration to figure that out. You're being told this is what you're good at because of this. And you're so long to hear that and get that validation that you believe it. And so that's why many people coming out of that, they go into careers that perpetuate that. And then 20 years down the road, wonder why they're not satisfied and they're feeling frustrated in their career. So they're skipping that important exploration time of who I am, what my passions are, what I'm good at, get through play and exploration as a child and trying all kinds of different hobbies and different things and sports and music, et cetera. I think the other thing with the parentification is it often awakens things too early. Now you have this almost emotional incest intimacy that begins to happen. And it feels good, but it feels wrong at the same time. So there's a bit of kind of cognitive dissonance happening. I like it, but something doesn't feel right here. The other piece for many people is they hit their teen years and they go, screw this being super responsible. Screw this taking care of everybody. It's time I took care of me. And they go the other extreme of being self-indulgent. I'm just going to live for me. I'm going to do whatever I want. And they bound in a super rebel, self-indulgent, destructive way almost of instant gratification constantly.
Drugs and alcohol.
I'm taking care of myself now. And so for a lot of people, self-care isn't meeting all 12 needs. Self-care is just instant gratification and quite harmful for them.
Yeah, it's so insidious. How do you help clients determine whether or not, like in my situation, my therapist would never have me go to therapy with my parents. But I had somebody reach out to me recently. They're like, have you talked about family therapy much on the podcast? And I'm like, a little bit, but not really. Cause I feel like most of our families are too fucked up where it wouldn't be beneficial for us to go. So how do you help people make that determination?
Well, I think the first thing I present is the kind of the normal thing that happens for people when they go for family therapy is mom and dad haven't owned their stuff. And so they're going to family. So if you picture your dad saying to you on Saturday, let's go for family therapy.
I wanted to say, let's go talk to your pastor. That's what I wanted to say.
And that's where, to me, it's interesting that I suspect kind of your parents would be in a religion that's actually supporting a narcissistic approach to families.
Well, he's Episcopalian, but you know what my dad does is that he donates half of his money to charity and tries to get people to come to Jesus as a way to, I remember being in Christmas one day and we were in church and I just saw the tears roll down his eye. And I know he just lives with such immense guilt, but sorry, go ahead.
Dad would be lots of money. And it became their status that everybody, it solved their shame, but nobody was actually dealing with the root issues. Often religion actually becomes an escape from shame for people, but it actually ends up feeling shame. So anyway, most people, when they go to, if your dad was wanting you to go to the therapist, it would be because he wants to bring the therapist in to put pressure on you to conform. And that's the disaster of most family therapy, is the parents aren't willing to look at their stuff or own their stuff or change. They just want the therapist to get the kid to change. And it ends up gaslighting them further because they've already been gaslit all their life and they get drawn back in. Okay, I'll try one more time. I'll conform one more time. And they actually regress in their recovery in order to try to please the family. To me, no family therapy should ever take place unless both parents are willing to own their part and look at their stuff and change. If that's not there, family therapy won't work. So to me, it takes it to a deeper issue, Andrea, which would be this. How old we get, there's still a part of us that longs that our biological family be healthy. So if we've been gaslit all our life that it's on us to make that happen, we'll hope that if we just do one more thing, we can.
If I say it the right way.
If they see enough changes in me, if I give them this video to watch, therapy, if I just, for them one more time, then maybe, and it just never works. And so to me, for people to realize, I should have to grieve never having a biological family that's healthy. It just may never happen. It's a loss that's painful, and I'm going to have to grieve it. But I have to replace that biological family with a surrogate family that's actually healthy. And if I do that, actually end up with quite a meaningful family, meet my needs way better than my biological family, and it's going to respect me where I can thrive and grow, very satisfying as far as connection and intimacy. But a lot of people are afraid to kind of switch and start investing in that surrogate family because they're still hoping that somehow they can get their biological family to change. And they can spend years work on that, only up disappointed. And I just say, yeah, while you're trying to your biological family change, at least start putting some energy into a surrogate family.
What do you think about like survivor's guilt?
Be real, for sure. For me, survivor's guilt goes to understanding the brain. Mm-hmm. The brain and the cortex, which are kind of the two main parts, like there's the brain stem, but that we need to understand.
Maybe I should say, if people don't want to know, like, I mean, from the perspective of like feeling guilty if you're the one in the family to get help and the rest of your family stays behind, just in case somebody doesn't know what we're talking about.
Okay. The brain is the emotional part of brain. It's the child part of the brain. It's the survival part of the brain, but that's where we feel emotion. So we feel guilt there. We feel fear there. We feel pain, loss. Everything is felt in the limbic brain, but that brain the child had. That's the part of the brain that if I can't resolve pain, then I got to get out of that part of the brain. I got to fight or flee. I got to escape. And so that's what addiction is, escaping my painful limbic brain. The cortex is the thinking part of the brain where we figure out what healthy is. The limbic brain is only concerned about feeling good now, instant gratification, being safe now. It doesn't think of long-term consequences. It doesn't think about what's healthy. Its priority is to feel good emotions only, all the time, now. What is so important to understand, when a person is in recovery, they can go along in their cortex, living a healthy life, but then all of a sudden something happens that triggers their limbic brain, that triggers a negative emotion, guilt. And what happens with that is they go back to tools that a child would use to handle those emotions. Mm-hmm. I got to flight, I got to medicate, I got to numb, I got to distract, I got to get angry. Whatever works to not feel this, they go back to that. And what I tell people is survivor's guilt will get triggered. You're going to have days where you feel guilty that you're the only one that's made it, you're the only one that's doing well. And that's going to trigger not just your limbic brain, it's going to trigger all the old patterns of that emotion in your limbic brain, which is, I need to sabotage my own recovery. I need to of everybody else. I need to give in to everybody else's request. All of those are unhealthy. And so you got to get out of your limbic brain back to your cortex and go, hey, I'm always going to have this guilt pop up, but I don't have to act on it in the old. Here's a healthier way to act on it and begin to kind of implement those new cortex tools so that I start responding to those guilt triggers in healthy ways and not go back to the old way.
Yeah. And I guess it's also too, it's just the system is set up in a way to pull you back in, you know, just like a cult.
That's to me why we talk about with complex trauma is it creates a default setting within our brains, in our subconscious of what feels normal and what feels right. So a narcissist dad, being that's always wrong, that's never good enough, having people abandon me, et cetera, that normal. And thing in our brain, when we go to healthy, it feels wrong. It feels confusing. It feels not right. And so our brain wants to go back and it has this gravitational pull. I want to go back to what feels normal, what feels, I know how to deal with this. And so to me, one of the tragedies of complex trauma is it creates a normal that's very unhealthy. But it's, you know, they're normal. And so your brain is always going to want to go back to that because it feels comfortable. And actually feeling healthy feels unsafe. It feels wrong. It feels very confusing. It creates all these emotions that are uncomfortable. So I'd rather go back to what's familiar than to sit in the unknown. Because something bad might happen up there because I might make a mistake. I might not know what to do. So let's go back to what I know, where I know what to do. And so that default setting is constantly in our brain, has mechanisms in place to take us back there. And to me, that's part of early warning signs in recovery, learning when I'm sliding back to that default setting and catching it before I slide back too far. Because once I slide back too far, I can't stop. And the earlier warning signs I can pick up on, the better.
Yeah. And that also, when you're talking about sliding back, it makes me think about like early recovery and also why it's like I've read in so many books how like between 5 to 10 years of sobriety is when all your shit comes up. And I guess part of it is like just because I think about it for me, like I was just nonstop program, like for the first 5 years, just going to meetings constantly. So that keeps you busy, but it's, I'm curious your perspective on, cause you know, like AA saved my life, but obviously, you know, it doesn't go deep enough. And there's some things that now I do take issue with, you know, like character defects. I think that, so whenever I'm in meetings, I really try to, when it's appropriate, to try to speak to that stuff, because there's a lot of people sitting in the rooms thinking, I've worked the steps. I've prayed for my defects to go away. I'm still doing this shit. There must be something horribly wrong with me, you know? Or I think about fourth and fifth steps. Like, it was okay for me, but for some people that could be horribly traumatic. So I'm just curious for your thoughts on this topic.
In my mind, big picture, Andrea, programs are always going to have an important function. You have some issues as well. So I understand recovery from trauma, recovery from addiction. There's really two main components, and that is you need new information, a new way of understanding life and understanding how to be healthy and what I was doing that was unhealthy. So there's a huge self-awareness teaching piece, but there's also a connection piece. I can't do this alone. I need to build relationships. I need to create a surrogate family. There has to be connection. So to me, Bill W. saw that. And he provided the connection, which I think AA continues to provide that surrogate family for thousands and thousands of people in a very important way. But he tried to, in the 1950s, provide the teaching based on the best.
Yeah, instead of information. Yeah.
And what we've come to see is a lot of it was good, but there's some stuff that wasn't quite bang on. And so sadly, what it then did was create this way now, instead of adapting to the new information that was coming out and changing some of the 12 steps and changing some of the vocabulary to what would be more accurate in what we're learning today. And so what I tell a lot of people that take our programs is involved in 12-step connection piece. Use some practical steps you can take. But man, if you don't do this deeper stuff, that's only going to keep you at a certain level of growth. And then you're going to kind of stagnate or level off. So if you can find a way to have both, what we're doing on the deeper level and stuff, that connection piece through 12-step, fantastic. And I think the other piece to me with the 12-step, it's such a necessary initial lifeline for people. Mm-hmm. They got someplace to go every day, somebody that they can call, a sponsor, steps that they can do that help them get out of the chaos and the craziness of it all. In those early days, it's really a vital lifeline to a lot of people.
Absolutely. It absolutely does. Yeah. I mean, so I'm in Florida now. And I'm in North Florida, which is like kind of like living in the South. So it's just interesting to, I mean, when I first got sober, it felt like anybody with long-term sobriety, it was like, life sucked. I got sober and life's been amazing ever since. Or like, life on life's terms happens, but mistakes of my own making are ceased the day I got sober. And so that's why I'm like, I'm miserable. Like, what the hell is wrong with me? And then thankfully, when I moved to San Francisco, there were people talking about it, you know? And kind of this second great surrender that frequently happens.
Yeah. What I saw with, so when I was in Winnipeg, there was tons of 12-step groups, ACA, NA, SA, just on and on. Some of them were really good groups and some of them were not so good groups. And what I saw in ones that weren't so good is they actually had become kind of dysfunctional, complex trauma.
Family systems.
Everybody would be happy all the time. You had to go into a certain level of denial about being honest about how you're really feeling and your own struggles and just do the steps and you're fixed. There was only kind of one tool available. And if you weren't happy, then wasn't steps fault. Something was wrong with you. But we're not willing to evaluate whether we're missing some pieces here. And so there was a gaslighting almost that was happening with some of the groups. And it was the groups that were willing to go, hey, maybe there is more out there in this trauma piece we need to be open to. Those were the groups that I saw thriving. It was always just interesting to me how such a thing that has a good start can actually become a complex trauma family again.
Mm-hmm. Get the wrong picture. Of course. What do you think, if there's anybody listening right now who is like, you know, in AA, but let's say they're, you know, they haven't necessarily like worked an ACA program or dealt with their own complex trauma, but they are in AA or NA or even Al-Anon. What do you think is crucial for people to know as it relates to this?
Yeah, like what I tell our clients all the time is if you take our program, you're going to do our deeper step 4, 5, 6, and 7. Mm-hmm. So you're going to do that inventory, but it's going to go beyond just resentments and harm done to others and sexual indiscretion stuff. Mm-hmm. It's going to go even deeper than that. And then we're going to reframe that into the ways you learn to cope to survive. And we're going to take the negative stigma out of that and say that the necessary adaptations you've had as a child to survive now have become maladaptations. But that little child going to survive and do what was necessary to survive. So we're going to character defect thing out of that and just begin to look at your adaptations and what you did survive but are maladaptations today, and then figure out what healthy look like and healthy coping looks like. So to me, it's really within step 4, 5, 6, and 7. You still need to go on and do service. You still need to grow on to have daily disciplines and routines every day that feed your soul. Those are definitely part of what we do and part of what you do. Just kind of framing it within the 12 steps that the per step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important to know too, even just for people that do hear other people's fifth steps, to be aware of this stuff, or if, you know, if somebody gets triggered, or you just never know what somebody's going to say back, or it could be dangerous for some people.
And what I do with people at a church, if they come out of 12 step, is letting you get kind of buzz terms within religions and 12 steps that everybody thinks they understand, but actually there's been a lot of misunderstandings developed. Forgiveness and resentments, for example. If you misunderstand that, it can do a ton of damage to people in recovery. Because all of a sudden, you must have resentments. No, you just got legitimate anger from bad stuff that happened to you. You should forgive them right now. Well, forgiveness happens gradually as you work on yourself and heal. It's just be open to kind of deconstruct some of the buzz terms that you've been given and just begin to make sure you have a proper understanding of them.
This has been so amazing. What do you want to promote, push? What are you jazzed about? What do you want to tell my fellow recovering shit shows about?
Like, I think to me, all of my work has resulted in providing an online course for people just to begin to help them deal with their trauma, learn what healthy looks like. And so we get people from over 30 countries in the world now that take our online program. And so it's called LIFT.
You have one coming up in September or August. I think one of my members is doing that one.
Our Compass program. That's our training people to actually coach in.
Oh, okay.
But LIFT is an ongoing thing. It's just, if people want to really start to dig in and work on this stuff, having a program with skilled people leading it to me is so necessary and helpful. Go to the website, timfletcher.ca, and find out about that. But I would just, to me, a lot of people can watch the YouTube videos and a lot of people can get a certain amount of teaching and it takes them so far and gets them started.
Yeah,
but they got to go deeper and
they got to do it. No shit.
Otherwise, at a certain point, runs and stops. So.
Okay, the last thing I wanted to tell you is get your opinion on. So my friend who lives in Canada, so she says that Saskatchewan and Manitoba are the lost children. Quebec is the scapegoat. Newfoundland is the joker. Alberta is the hero. And Ontario is parentified for sure. Just the theory. That's what she said.
Yeah, probably quite accurate. Very good. Never heard it put that way before, but I like it.
Yeah, well, that's what I said. I was like, is this like a thing or something you came up with? She lives in Quebec now, but she's from Alberta originally. So yeah, when she saw where you lived, she was like, oh, he's from the lost child of Canada.
Well, we're in Southern Ontario now, so we haven't been in Manitoba for 3.5 years, but
Well, thank
I
you for
go to there.
Yeah, I thank you so much for the amazing work that you're doing. Thank you for saving lives and getting this information out in a way that people can receive. And so grateful for people like you who have given us the opportunity to heal and live the life we're supposed to live. So grateful for your time.
Thank you for having me, Andrea.